Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette and Fort Dodge Messenger for Monday, April 8th, 2024. I'm your reader, Grace Barter. The Perry Community School District, still recovering after a deadly shooting in January, will be able to pay retention bonuses to its staff and waive some state requirements under a bill Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds signed into law on Friday. The bill, House File 2653, came after lawmakers promised to help the school and enact new safety measures after a student shot and killed two people and wounded six others at the school on January 4th. The law does not provide additional state funding, but it will allow the school to pay retention bonuses to its teachers and staff out of its district management tax levy. The district can spend up to $700,000 on the bonuses. The law also waives a list of state requirements on standardized testing, instruction hours, reporting, and graduation requirements for students at Perry during the current school year. Students were out of class for nearly a month after the shooting. The bill was passed nearly unanimously in both chambers of the legislature. Republican Representative Mark Cisneros of Muscatine was the only lawmaker to vote no. Speaking on the Senate floor on Tuesday, Senator Chris Cornoyer, a Republican from LeClaire, said the Iowa Association of School Boards and the Perry District worked with other school districts across the country that had experienced similar tragedies to come up with proposals to help the district recover. Senator Herman Kornbach, a Democrat from Ames, supported the bill, but he said he would have liked to see the state provide the funding to pay the teachers, rather than allow the school to use its existing budget. He said working to keep teachers in the district is the right thing to do. Representative Carter Nordman, a Republican from Panora, whose district includes Perry, managed the bill in the House. He said teacher retention is one of the biggest problems districts deal with in the wake of school shootings. Iowa City Democrat and former Representative Christina Bohannon raised $820,000 in the first 3 months of 2024, according to her campaign. She is running to unseat Iowa U.S. Representative Marionette Miller Meeks, a Republican from Ottumwa, in southeast Iowa's 1st Congressional District. Bohannon's campaign said it has raised $2.1 million in this election cycle, including the most recent totals. Miller Meeks' campaign did not immediately respond Friday with its first quarter fundraising numbers. Campaigns have until April 15th to report contributions and expenditures for the quarter ending March 31st with the Federal Elections Commission. Both Bohannon's and Miller Meeks' campaigns had yet to file reports as of Friday afternoon, according to a search for filings on the FEC's website. Miller Meeks' campaign raised $1.7 million between January 1, 2023 and December 31, 2023, and had nearly $1.6 million cash on hand, according to its latest FEC filing. Bohannon raised $1.3 million as of the end of last year, with $1.1 million cash on hand. According to the Bohannon campaign, that total is the most for a House challenger in an off year. According to the campaign, 75% of her contributions come from Iowans. David Pouch, a Davenport Republican known for organizing the annual Quad Cities Prayer Breakfast, is challenging Miller Meeks for the GOP nomination in the June primary. The FEC did not list contribution filings for Pouch in 2023 as of Friday. Des Moines Democrat Lannon Beckham, who is running to challenge Iowa U.S. Representative Zach Nunn, a Republican from Bondurant, announced raising more than $900,000 for the quarter. Nunn's campaign did not immediately respond Friday with its first quarter fundraising numbers for 2024. According to Beckham's campaign, the haul sets a record for the highest first quarter fundraising for a congressional challenger in Iowa. Nunn's campaign raised $2 million between January 1st and December 31st, 2023, and had nearly $1.6 million cash on hand, according to its latest FEC filing. Beckham raised $500,000 last year with $444,500 cash on hand. A former U.S. Department of Agriculture official, veteran, and Democratic campaign operative, Beckham faces Melissa Vine, a Des Moines nonprofit leader who also is running for the Democratic nomination in the June primary. Vine's campaign had not reported its first quarter fundraising numbers as of Friday afternoon. It reported raising roughly $52,700 as of December 31st. Iowa Republican U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson of Marion raised more than $600,000 during the first 3 months of the year and has $1.65 million cash on hand, according to her campaign. Hinson, a former state lawmaker and former KCRG-TV news anchor, is running for a third term representing Northeast Iowa's 2nd Congressional District. Cedar Falls Democrat and small business owner Sarah Corkery is running to challenge Hinson. Corkery's campaign did not immediately respond Friday with its first quarter fundraising numbers for 2024. Her campaign reported raising roughly $51,000 as of December 31st. In the News Digest, a man was charged Sunday with setting a fire outside the Vermont office of U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders, federal prosecutors said. Shant Soghomanian, 35, who was previously of North Ridge, California, entered the building on Friday and went to Sanders' third-floor office, where security video showed him spraying a liquid on the door and setting it afire, officials said. The building's interior suffered some damage from the fire and sprinklers that doused the area with water, but no one was hurt. Sanders, an independent, was not in the office at the time. China's military said Sunday that it conducted air and sea patrols and that all activities that disrupt the South China Sea are under control, in apparent response to naval exercises by the U.S. and its allies. The defense chiefs of the United States, Japan, Australia, and the Philippines announced Saturday that they would hold joint exercises in the sea to safeguard the rule of law and uphold the right to sail through and fly over the waters. China has long simmering territorial disputes with a number of Southeast Asian nations in the South China Sea, a major shipping route. An eastern Pennsylvania man has been charged with involuntary manslaughter in the death of a 3-year-old boy who authorities say shot himself with a handgun left unattended last month. Jose Hilario Abreu, 28, of Allentown, Pennsylvania, was arraigned Friday on the charge as well as two counts of child endangerment. Russia's government declared the situation in flood-hit areas in the Orenburg region a federal emergency on Sunday, with preparations for possible flooding underway in three other regions, state media reported. The floods, caused by rising water levels in the Ural River, forced over 4,000 people to evacuate in the Orenburg region. an exit poll released after Poland's local and regional elections Sunday showed Prime Minister Donald Tusk's pro-EU party trailing the conservative opposition party that governed Poland for 8 years until December. According to the poll, Law and Justice won 33.7% of votes and Tusk's Civic Coalition won 31.9%. A motorcycle bomb killed 2 people and wounded 5 in Pakistan southwest, a police official said Sunday. It's the latest unrest to hit Baluchistan province, where militants have tried to target a naval facility in recent weeks. Pennsylvania-based AHF Products said it will purchase West Virginia's Allegheny Wood Products sawmills in the Greenbrier County community of Smoot and the Randolph County community of Norton. AHF said in a statement that about 80 jobs will be saved at the two mills. 2 Papuan separatist leaders were killed in a shootout between security forces and their rebel group near one of the world's largest gold mines in Indonesia's restive Papua region, police said Sunday. Clashes occurred Thursday between independence rebels of the Free Papua Movement and a joint police and military force near the mining town of Tembagapura. The head of the UN's Atomic Watchdog Agency on Sunday condemned a Ukrainian drone strike on one of 6 nuclear reactors at the Russian-controlled Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant in Ukraine, saying such attacks significantly increase the risk of a major nuclear accident. In a statement on the social media platform X, Rafael Mariano Grossi confirmed at least 3 direct hits against the ZNPP main reactor containment structures took place. "This cannot happen," he said. He said it was the first such attack since November 2022, when he set out 5 basic principles to avoid a serious nuclear accident with radiological consequences. Officials at the plant said the site was attacked Sunday by Ukrainian military drones, including a strike on the dome of the plant's 6th power unit. According to the plant authorities, there was no critical damage or casualties, and radiation levels at the plant were normal after the strikes. Later on Sunday, however, Russian state-owned nuclear agency Rosatom said that 3 people were wounded in the unprecedented series of drone attacks, specifically when a drone hit an area close to the site's canteen. The International Atomic Energy Agency said Sunday that its experts had been informed of the drone strike and that such detonation is consistent with IAEA observations. In a separate statement, the IAEA confirmed physical impact of drone attacks at the plant, including at one of its 6 reactors. The global condemnation of Ecuador's government for its decision to break into the Mexican embassy snowballed Sunday, with more presidents and other leaders expressing disapproval, shock, and dismay. The criticism came as Mexico's ambassador and other personnel arrived in Mexico City on Sunday afternoon after departing Ecuador's capital, Quito, on a commercial flight. President Andre Manuel Lopez Obrador severed diplomatic ties with Ecuador immediately after Friday's raid, which international law experts, presidents, and diplomats have deemed a violation of long-established international accords. Alicia Bárcena, Mexico's Secretary of Foreign Relations, thanked the returning diplomats for defending our embassy in Quito, even at the risk of their own physical well-being. Not even the dictator Pinochet had dared to enter the Mexican embassy in Chile, she said Sunday, referring to the late Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet. They entered violently and without authorization, physically assaulting diplomats. We energetically condemn it. Police broke through the external doors of the embassy to arrest Jorge Glass, a former vice president who had been residing there since December. He had sought asylum after being indicted on corruption charges. Barcena said Mexico plans to challenge the raid on Monday at the World Court in The Hague. She added that 18 countries in Latin America, 20 in Europe, and the Organization of American States have backed Mexico. The Spanish Foreign Ministry, in a statement Sunday, said the entry by force into the embassy of Mexico in Quito constitutes a violation of the 1961 Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations. We call for respect for international law and harmony between Mexico and Ecuador, brotherly countries to Spain and members of the Ibero-American community. A day earlier, the OAS, in a statement, reminded its members, which include Ecuador and Mexico, of their obligation not to invoke norms of domestic law to justify non-compliance with their international obligations. U.S. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller said the United States condemns any violation of the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations and takes very seriously the obligation of host countries under international law to respect the inviolability of diplomatic missions. He called on the two countries to resolve their differences. Diplomatic premises are considered foreign soil and inviolable under the Vienna treaties, and host country law enforcement agencies are not allowed to enter without the permission of the ambassador. Glass on Saturday was taken from the Attorney General's office in Quito to the port city of Guayaquil, where he is being housed at a maximum security prison. U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen sent a message of mutual cooperation at a meeting Sunday with Chinese Premier Li Huang, highlighting the improvement in relations since her visit to China last year, while recognizing that major differences remain. After focusing on trade and economic issues for the first 2 days of her visit, Yellen turned to the broader U.S.-China relationship in the meeting with Li, one of China's top leaders. While we have more to do, I believe that over the past year we have put our bilateral relationship on more stable footing, she said in the ornate Fujian Room of the Great Hall of the People on the west side of Tiananmen Square. Yellen, who is regarded favorably in China, is the first cabinet member to visit since Presidents Joe Biden and Xi Jinping met in California in November in a carefully orchestrated meeting to set the troubled relationship between their countries on a better course. Li, in remarks before the media before their meeting, said the high media interest in Yellen's visit shows the high expectation they have and also the expectation and hope to grow the U.S.-China relationship. China's emergence as an economic and military power has created a rivalry with the long-dominant United States. The U.S. has restricted China's access to advanced semiconductors and other technology, saying it could be used for military purposes. China, still a middle-income country, accuses the U.S. of trying to constrain its economic development. At their meeting, Li told Yellen that China hopes the U.S. won't politicize economic and trade issues or overstretch the definition of national security, the official Xinhua news agency said. Yellen came to China with trade practices that put American companies and workers at an unfair competitive disadvantage at the top of her agenda. Chinese government subsidies and other policy support have encouraged solar panel and EV makers in China to invest in factories, building far more production capacity than the domestic market can absorb. While that has driven down prices for consumers, Western governments fear that the capacity will flood their markets with low-priced exports, threatening American and European jobs. But Li argued that the development of the green energy industry in China would make an important contribution to combating climate change, the Xinhao report said. The U.S. and China on Saturday agreed to hold intensive exchanges on more balanced economic growth, according to a U.S. statement issued after Yellen and Chinese Vice Premier He Lifeng held extended meetings over 2 days in the southern city of Guangzhou. They also agreed to start exchanges on combating money laundering. It was not immediately clear when and where the talks would take place. There are no obituaries in the paper today, so we move on to some sports news. Camila Cardoza delivered once again for Dawn Staley and South Carolina. A perfect finish, a dynasty, a team too big for Caitlin Clark in Iowa this time around. Cardoza had 15 points and a career-high 17 rebounds, and South Carolina completed its perfect season with an 87-75 victory over Clark and the Hawkeyes in the NCAA championship game on Sunday. With Staley directing a relentless attack from the sideline, the Gamecocks, 38-0, became the 10th Division I team to go through a season without a loss, and they accomplished the feat after they lost all five starters from last season's team that lost to Clark's squad in the national semifinals. Clark did all she could to lead the Hawkeyes to their first championship. She scored 30 points, including a championship record 18 in the first quarter. She rewrote the record book at Iowa, 34-5, finishing as the career-leading scorer in the NCAA Division I history with 3,951 points. She hopes her legacy isn't defined by falling short in two NCAA championship games, but more by the millions of new fans she helped bring into the game and the countless young girls and boys that she inspired. As the final buzzer sounded, a stoic Clark walked off the court, through the confetti, and into the tunnel heading to the locker room. South Carolina has won three titles in the last 8 years, including two of the past three, to lay claim to being the latest dynasty in women's basketball. Staley became the fifth coach to win at least three national championships, joining Gina Auriemma, Pat Summitt, Kim Mulkey, and Tara Vanderveer. The Gamecocks, who have won 109 of their last 112 games, became the first team since UConn in 2016 to go undefeated. South Carolina had a couple scares throughout the season, but always found a way to win. With most of the team returning next year, Staley's team is in a good position to keep this run going. The NCAA men's tournament has reached its finish line, down to one game pairing the two best teams that routinely win in romps, and boasting a marquee post matchup that features a two-time National Player of the Year. Maybe that will make this version of March Madness something to remember after all. Reigning champion UConn meets Purdue on Monday night in a matchup of top seeds that have combined to win their first five tournament games by an average margin of 22.3 points. They have been at the center of a tournament lacking in drama, with its second highest average margin of victory since the field expanded to 64 teams in 1985. Only one last-second winning shot and a few of the highlight reel thrills that had become a staple of the event. Don't expect the Huskies or Boilermakers to feel the least bit bothered by their dominance either. People that love basketball and people that really know the game, you watch good basketball. Purdue guard Fletcher Loyer said Sunday, obviously the upsets are fun and real cool and they get attention, but real basketball, you'll like to see the two best teams go at it, and I think that's what we have here. As for those last second shots that live on in tournament lore, the closest this year was KJ Simpson rattling in a baseline jumper with 1.7 seconds left to lift Colorado past Florida 102-100 in round one. Everything else has largely been about UConn's run to greatness and Purdue's march to redemption from last year's stunning loss to 16th-seeded Farley Dickinson. And in entertainment news, Godzilla vs. Kong, the new empire, easily swatted away a pair of challengers to hold on to the top spot at the box office for the second week in a row, according to studio estimates Sunday. After its above expectations $80 million launch last weekend, the MonsterVerse mashup brought in $31.7 million over its second weekend, a 60% drop from its debut. The Warner Brothers and Legendary Pictures release, directed by Adam Wingard, has thus far outperformed any of the studio's recent monster films, except for 2014's Godzilla. But with around $300 million worldwide in 2 weeks, Godzilla vs. Kong could ultimately leapfrog the $529 million global haul of 2014's Godzilla, the latest installment in which Godzilla and Kong team up, cost about $135 million to produce. Godzilla vs. Kong extended its box office reign as another primate-themed movie arrived in theaters. Dev Patel's Monkey Man, an India-set revenge thriller released by Universal Pictures, opened in 3,029 North American theaters with an estimated $10.1 million. That marked a strong debut for Patel's modestly budgeted directorial debut, in which he stars in a bloody, politically charged action extravaganza. Monkey Man, which cost about $10 million to make, was dropped by its original studio, Netflix, after which Jordan Peele and his Monkey Paw Productions swooped in. The weekend's other new wide release, The First Omen, from Disney's 20th Century Studios, struggled to make a big impact with moviegoers. It came in third with an estimated $8.4 million in ticket sales in 3,375 theaters, while collecting an additional $9.1 million overseas. The R-rated horror film, which cost about $30 million to make, is a prequel to the 1976 Richard Donner-directed original starring Gregory Peck and Lee Remick. This version, directed by Arkasha Stevenson and starring Nell Tiger-Free, Tawfiq Barhoum, and Bill Nighy, follows 2006's The Omen, which opened to $16 million and ultimately grossed $119 million. The tepid opening for The First Omen allowed Sony's Ghostbusters Frozen Empire to take third place with $9 million in its third weekend of release. The sci-fi comedy sequel has collected $88.8 million domestically and $138 million worldwide. Warner Brothers' Dune Part 2 continues to perform strongly. It added $7.2 million in its sixth week, dipping just 37%, to bring its domestic total to $264 million. One of the week's biggest performers was in China, where Hayao Miyazaki's Oscar-winning The Boy and the Heron landed in theaters. The acclaimed Japanese anime is setting records for a non-Chinese animated film. After opening Wednesday, its five-day total surpassed $70 million, a new high mark for Miyazaki and Studio Ghibli. And that does it for the Mason City Globe Gazette for today. Now we'll switch over to the Fort Dodge Messenger. Tables and chairs sized just right for small children are set up in the classrooms, while out in the halls, wooden cubby holes await little jackets and hats. Kingdom Kids of St. Olaf is all set, and if the next round of inspections goes well, it will welcome its first youngsters at the end of this month. The progress on the newest child care facility in Fort Dodge was celebrated during an open house Sunday afternoon in St. Olaf Lutheran Church, 239 North 11th Street. During that open house, representatives of Cargill, which has a plant west of Fort Dodge, presented a $70,000 donation. That donation is part of the $2,542,457 raised so far for the center. The goal of the capital campaign is $3 million. The church's efforts to meet that need began in 2021. St. Olaf Lutheran Church has a foundation, and it has been receiving requests for money to start child care centers, according to Reverend Emily Sawyer Alvarez, the church's pastor. We started thinking, we have a lot of space that isn't used during the week. What if we did a daycare center, she said. That space she referred to is in the south end of the church, in what used to be Sunday school classrooms. In the fall of 2021, the congregation voted to move forward with a daycare center. Church representatives then started meeting with the State Department of Health and Human Services to learn about the requirements for a daycare center. In January 2022, a $687,000 state grant was received. The fundraising campaign started that fall. Denklau was hired as the director in January 2023. She has 25 years of experience providing in-home child care and was the first director of the Community Christian School Child Care Center. She began what she called the long, tedious process of writing all the policies, procedures, and curriculums needed for a child care facility. While she was doing that, renovations got started in the building. Much of that work focused on the heating, ventilation, and air conditioning system. A lot of money was spent on infrastructure that you don't get to see, Denklau said. New security systems, including cameras in every classroom, were also installed. The renovation started in July of 2023. The center will be initially licensed for 130 children, with the possibility of eventually going to 190 children. Those children will range in age from 6 weeks old to 12 years old. The center will be open from 6:30 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. Monday through Friday. Before school and after school programs will be offered. There will be a chapel service on Wednesdays for the children. Kingdom Kids of St. Olaf will initially have a staff of 16 people, including Denklau, 13 teachers, and 2 kitchen workers. A garage and a car were destroyed in a Saturday evening fire in Fort Dodge that was fanned by powerful wind gusts. No one was injured in the blaze at 909 South 27th Street. The very strong winds in the area were the root cause of the fire, according to Fire Chief Steve Hergenreder. He said the winds knocked down power lines in the alley behind 909 South 27th Street. Those live wires ignited grass and a wooden fence. The flames rapidly spread to the car, which was parked outside the garage and the building. The fire was reported at 6:35 p.m. Firefighters arrived to find the car and the garage on fire, with flames threatening to spread to the house and a neighboring garage. Firefighters used two hose lines to extinguish the blaze. They prevented the fire from spreading into the house and limited damage to the neighboring garage. Part of the roof on the burning garage caved in. Off-duty firefighters were called back to work to handle any other emergencies in the city. Hergenreder said they responded to three medical emergency calls while the other firefighters were working on South 27th Street. The property is owned by Timothy and Julie Pingle. Fort Dodge Police and Mid-American Energy crews responded along with the fire department. Howling wind drove the flames early Sunday morning that eventually destroyed the Stonga Grain Elevator west of Webster City on Old Highway 20. Fire departments from as far away as Alden in Hardin County and Eagle Grove and Clarion in Wright County converged on the site to help Hamilton County firefighters fight the fire at the United Cooperative site near where Old 20 or 220th Street intersects with Stonga Avenue. As many as 15 fire departments responded to the fire. The blaze was called in around 1:15 a.m. Sunday to Camrar Fire, according to Holly Mortensen, whose husband, Tim Mortensen, is chief of Camrar Fire. It was quickly turned over to Blairsburg Fire, she said. Sunday afternoon, those two departments were still monitoring the smoldering site. Blairsburg, Camrar, and Williams will rotate watching it, Mortensen said. The cause of the fire is unknown and will likely stay unknown due to the extensive damage. Even with the support of Webster City and even Eagle Grove aerial trucks and multiple tankers and manpower from the many departments on scene, they could not put the fire out. "We didn't have enough water to help the fire at all," Mortensen said. Lost were 330,000 bushels of soybeans and a 1954 wooden elevator and all of its components. Two other bins, their contents, and all of their components were also lost. "A new structure built 3 years ago did not burn," she said, "but it will have to be inspected because of the tremendous heat of the neighboring blaze." Some of the fire debris spilled onto the Chicago Central and Pacific Railroad tracks, which run adjacent to the Stonga site. On Sunday afternoon, workers for that company were at Stonga doing repairs to the tracks. The line was expected to be reopened at the end of the day. Stonga became part of the United Cooperative in 1977, according to a history of the site written by the late Ed Nass. Originally, it was organized at the Stonga Home Elevator Company. Stonga could not really be considered a settlement, Nass wrote. Primarily, it was a stop on the Illinois Central Railroad, where stock and grain could be loaded on the train. It was located about a mile west of Druid's Siding. The elevator was organized in 1912 as the Stonga Home Elevator Company, which was owned and operated by a few farmers. The scale pit was dug on January 1, 1913, a very cold time to be digging. The station stop was named, according to the railroad officials, for Mr. Stone, the division superintendent for the Waterloo Fort Dodge Division. Atlases dated 1915 and the 1920 gave the name as Stone Eagle, but the residents in the area insisted that the name was always Stonga. From 1920 to the present, the Stonga name has always been used. At 6:32 p.m. Sunday, Blairsburg Fire returned to the station. "Thanks for everyone who helped today," a weary voice said over the radio. A pair of outdoor projects plus proposed new rules regarding permits for animal breeders will be considered by the Fort Dodge City Council tonight. The council meeting will begin at 6 p.m. in the Municipal Building, 819 First Avenue South. Both of the outdoor projects are near or on existing trails. One of the projects involves restoring wetlands and stream connections near the north end of the Fort Dodge Nature Trail. The work would be done just south of 170th Street. Through a relatively new program, the city will be able to use money from the state's revolving loan program for sanitary sewer work to pay for this project without incurring any extra costs. The other outdoor project will create a trail connection between the Union Pacific Railroad High Bridge. Doyle Construction submitted the apparent low bid for that work as well, with a price of about $287,000. Last month, Webster County Animal Protection, which provides animal control services to the city and county, asked the county to add some requirements to its existing permits for animal breeders. In response, the council will consider the first of three required readings of some additional requirements when it meets tonight. Those new requirements will include listing the address where the breeding animal will be housed, written approvals from a veterinarian, microchips for the animals, and standards for the enclosure where the animal will be kept. In area sports news, the Fort Dodge boys are excited to compete inside their home stadium Monday night as the 65th annual Dodger Relays take place. Joining the host school will be St. Edmund, Humboldt, Eagle Grove, Boone, Marshalltown, Mason City, and Waukee Northwest. Field events begin at 4:30 p.m. with running events at 4:45 p.m. The overall look of things will be a bit different as construction continues on the stadium for new facilities. Concession stands will be open at the baseball diamond and southeast corner for fans and athletes. Last year, Waukee Northwest finished first with 221 points as Mason City placed second and Fort Dodge was third. Humboldt and St. Edmund rounded out the top five. Among those who won individual titles last year that are expected to compete include Humboldt's Mason Van Pelt, who picked up the 400 title over Hayden Moorhead of Waukee Northwest, and Lance Kuhn, who won the long jump. Joel Bloomer of Waukee Northwest won the 1600 as a junior for the Wolves. Senior recognition for the Dodgers will take place between the 400-meter wheelchair and 4x200 relay events. Two of the relays this year have special meaning to longtime Fort Dodge High School coaches, as the 4x800 is named for Rod Reeson and the closing 4x400 for Sam Moser. Last year, Mason City set the meet record in the 4x400 with a time of 3 minutes, 20 seconds, and 41. The Dodgers set the meet record in the sprint medley in 2021 and own the top marks in the 100 courtesy Cray Washington, 110 hurdles by Alonzo Clayton, 200 from current FDSH head football coach Nick Moser, 400 hurdles by Jordan Crosby, the shot put by Troy Krause, and the long jump from Mark Charolais. The Iowa Central softball team picked up another sweep here on Saturday versus Iowa Lakes. The scores were 8-0 and 12-1 in favor of the Tritons, who are 23-11 overall, 6-2 in the ICCAC. In the opener, Bree Nolte and Jada Long each had 3 hits, with Nolte driving in 4 and Long 3. Morgan Weeks added 2 hits and a pair of RBI in support of Emma Hoyle. Hoyle pitched the first 4 innings, striking out 8. Kennedy Palmer was 4-for-4 with 2 RBI and a steal in the nightcap, as Alina Sandy added 2 hits and 2 RBI. Jaden Starr earned the win, striking out 7, and Kalen Hardy picking up 4 strikeouts over 2 innings of work. The Lakers are now 10-18 and 1-7. The Tritons return to action Monday when they host Ellsworth, who is 15-15, at 4 p.m. for a doubleheader at Rogers Park. The Fort Dodge Stags earned 2 wins over traditional rugby powers on Friday at the West Des Moines Shootout. The Stags took down West Des Moines Valley by a final of 29-10 and Southeast Polk at 12-7. Seniors Bo Colwell and Ty Adams, juniors Gavin Peterson and Quentin Jeske, sophomore Jesse Igley all converted tries in the rout of Valley. Junior Carlos Elias made good on 3 of 5 conversion attempts. Egley and senior Drayton Miller had tries in the win over SEP. Fort Dodge returns to action at Ames on Friday. The Stags will face Iowa City West at 6:50 p.m. and Ankeny Centennial at 8:30 p.m. The 5th-ranked Central baseball team was forced to settle for a split here Saturday with North Iowa area Rogers Park. After winning the opener 5-4, the Tritons, 29-5 overall, 7-5 in the ICCAC, dropped the nightcap 8-6. A 4-run fourth erased a 2-0 deficit for Iowa Central in the first game before the Trojans rallied to tie it. The Tritons won it in the bottom of the 7th. NIACC, 13-20 and 5-8, scored 3 in the 2nd and 4 in the 7th to take command in Game 2 before Iowa Central made it interesting with 4 in the bottom of the 9th. These two teams will play a single game on Monday at 1 p.m. And some thoughts from your representative, Tim Cranbrink. Senate File 2401 is one of the bills we debated last week to help support farmers and the agriculture industry in our state. In 1986, the Grain Indemnity Fund was created during the farm crisis and acts similar to an insurance policy for the grain farmers' store at grain elevators. Currently, all grain dealers and warehouse operators are required to participate in the Grain Indemnity Fund and pay fees on purchased or stored grain. If at the end of a fiscal year the fund exceeds $8 million, the fees are waived. But if the balance of the fund falls below $3 million, the Grain Indemnity Fund Board reinstates these fees. Senate File 2401 adjusts those amounts to $12 million and $5 million and also extends coverage to credit sale contracts. Last year, the Grain Indemnity Fund ran out of money due to a number of circumstances, and the fee had to be reinstated. This bill updates these numbers to better reflect today's economy and hopefully prevent additional fees on farmers in the future. HF 2653 also passed in response to the tragedy in Perry earlier this year. This bill allows Perry schools to offer retention bonuses to help retain their employees for the upcoming school year. It also waives various state requirements, including required days and hours of instruction, just for this year because students missed a month of school. During the opening days of session, legislators expressed their support for the Perry community, and this bill is one way to put action behind those words. The Iowa Senate passed Senate Joint Resolution 2004, a proposal to put a flat tax into the Iowa Constitution. SJR 2004 is a constitutional amendment, which means it needs to pass 2 consecutive General Assemblies before going before the people of Iowa for a vote. The constitutional amendment would add a single tax rate into the Constitution, ensuring one single rate for all Iowans and making it more difficult for a graduated tax rate to be put back into place. In 2022, the legislature passed a historic tax relief measure to implement a flat tax in Iowa, ensuring a fairer system so Iowans keep more of the money they earn. We do not believe Iowans should be punished for working hard to be successful. The 2022 tax cut is in addition to several other tax relief measures passed since 2017. According to recent polling, not only have voters shown overwhelming support for requiring a two-thirds supermajority to increase tax rates in Iowa, they also have shown strong support for putting a flat tax in the Constitution. Iowans know this constitutional amendment would protect them from unfair tax increases, keep the tax code simpler, and limit irresponsible budgeting in future legislatures. I was proud to support this bill, and it now goes to the Iowa House for consideration. A big topic over the last several weeks has been the various products currently being sold in Iowa containing hemp and CBD. House File 2605 increases regulation and oversight of Iowa's consumable hemp law. This does not affect the state's current law on medical cannabidiol, which can still be used to treat several conditions, including seizures and epilepsy, chronic pain, and PTSD. Recreational marijuana is not legal in the state of Iowa, and I would not support the legalization of marijuana. I didn't vote in favor of this bill, however, because I felt it did not target the original intent. I felt there was too much overreach. It was my understanding that the original intent was to regulate the THC-infused social drinks. In Iowa, there are approximately 800,000 consumers with an average age of 57 that purchase these products for symptoms that range from migraine headaches to joint pain to insomnia. The product treating these symptoms is a natural hemp product that is grown from a plant versus a synthetic prescribed drug that can be addictive. I believe these products can be used to help Iowans with chronic health issues. I felt my decision to not support this legislation was the right vote for my constituents. The bill passed the Iowa Senate 31-18. And in today's obituaries, Sharon Lang, 83, of Fort Dodge, passed away Saturday, April 6th. A mass of Christian burial will be 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, April 10th at Holy Trinity Church. Burial will follow at Corpus Christi Cemetery. A visitation will be 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday at Laufersweil Funeral Home. Sharon Louise Hood was born November 30th, 1940 in Fort Dodge. She attended Corpus Christi School and graduated from St. Edmund High School in 1959. On May 20th, 1961, she was united in marriage to Frank Lang at Corpus Christi Church. Sharon first worked at Mercy Hospital from 1961 until 1969, before attending Burnell Beauty School in 1970. She retired from Just Deb's Beauty Salon in 2002. Sharon was a lifelong member of Holy Trinity Parish that enjoyed Saturday night masses at Sacred Heart. In her retirement, she stayed busy by greeting and covering the supper hour for Laufersweil Funeral Home. Memorials may be left to the discretion of the family. Pastor Mark David Heath, 69 of Keokuk, passed away Wednesday, April 3rd. Stephen Fair of Fort Dodge passed away April 6th. Private family interment will be held at the Iowa Veterans Cemetery. Memorials may be directed to the family. And that does it for the Monday, April 8th, 2024 reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette and Fort Dodge Messenger. I'm your reader, Grace Barter. Thanks for listening.